Welcome to Weather and Ag in Focus. I'm Chief Meteorologist Dean Wysocki, along with Bridget Riedel, our wonderful, talented ag director here on this Thursday. Why does it feel like a Monday? I guess after the holiday, all the days are kind of messed up, but it is Thursday and it's a short work week now. Some people are lucky enough to have the whole week off, though.
Yes, but thank you to those who are actually working on Christmas. I appreciate that. For someone who needed to stop to, whether it was fill fuel or that type of thing while traveling, thanks to those who did work through the Christmas holiday. Much appreciated that y'all were going the extra mile for many who are out on the roads especially.
Yeah, no doubt.
Thanks for that. Yeah, and last night coming back, there was some blowing and drifting snow. And I would venture a guess that road crews are out this morning taking care of some of that, because the closer to the Red River Valley, the more intense that wind and snow moving across the road. I would imagine many others experienced that as well in their travels yesterday.
Yeah, there's a little slick travel out there, but I guess it could have been worse. At least it wasn't like last year where we had the big ice storm just out to the west of the valley. So we didn't have to deal with that.
No. That wasn't just out to the west of the valley, my friend.
The worst of it was. Yeah, it was slick in town.
Well, town is one thing, but remember, for those of us who are only 30 miles out of town, we're still on the edge of the valley. We lost power from here to Page, North Dakota. We broke electrical poles. I mean, it was vicious last year for a lot of people. There were folks that were just within 45 minutes of Fargo that lost power for at least 10 days last year.
Yeah, it was.
So it was tremendous.
Yeah, it wasn't fun. That's for sure. So what a difference a year makes. Still mild this year, but at least we avoided any big storms. And according to the LRC, we're going to avoid any big storms over the next 10 days. We're not really looking at much in the way of anything coming our way. We're looking at quiet conditions for the rest of the afternoon with a lot of cloud cover around and temperatures in the mid-30s this afternoon with south-southeast winds at about 10 to 25. Overnight tonight, we're looking at a little bit of patchy fog possible with lows in the upper 20s. And then as we head into your Friday, we're looking at maybe a few sprinkles out there. Not a big deal. Moving in from the west as we head into the afternoon. Now, the far northern valley could see a little bit in the way of mixed precip, but I'm not expecting any travel troubles as we've got temperatures in the mid to upper 30s for tomorrow. And then the weekend, we'll finally see some sunshine come out with highs in the mid-30s. So normal highs this time of the year should be in the low 20s. So we're well above normal. Now, next week, we will finally see temperatures returning to normal. And after January 6th, that's when the Arctic opens up, and we're going to see some brutally cold weather. Now, if we're going to melt some of this snowpack away between now and the end of the weekend, where we will probably see some bare ground. Now, if we add to the snowpack before the Arctic air arrives after January 6th, which I think we'll probably add an inch or two with a couple of clipper systems coming our way, we're looking at nighttime lows between 15 and 25 below across the area, and wind chills approaching 40 to 50 below, because we're going to have quite a bit of wind with this. So it's not going to be fun as we head towards that second week in January. And it's not unheard of. I mean, we normally get the Arctic air coming in around then anyway, so not a huge surprise.
Just depends on how long that Arctic air will last. You know, this is a good time to give heads up for our livestock producers, because it's time to make sure windbreaks are in place, start stockpiling, whether you need to chop hay or anything like that, to make sure that you have everything in place that you will need. Get those deliveries done. If you are a homeowner, check your propane tanks. Make sure that you are ready to go for those longer extended periods of time for home heating, etc. And I think overall, it's important right now to remember that as we see that really cold temperature, things just get brittle. So if you were going to head outside and do any type of repairs because of cold weather, just remember it's going to function that much harder. Keep yourselves safe. Keep your pets safe as well. Cold weather like that as it approaches is life-threatening. And I realize in this day and age, most of us think, oh, don't worry, I have a phone. It's not that simple. So make sure to stay safe in all of this cold temperature that could be coming at us. And if we have snowfall that goes with it, that just increases the concern in case you get stranded. got to be careful.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, I think the main theme of this winter is the main storm track is going to be to the south. We just got the LRC kind of pinpointed down now. We're putting the pieces to the puzzle together. And it just, I'm not seeing any big, big storms here until sometime maybe February or March. I think the whole month of January is going to be pretty darn quiet. Now, again, outside of the cold, and now we could get, you know, one of those clipper systems come our way, giving us only a couple inches of snow, but if you get 30 to 40 mile an hour winds with that, then that, you know, that could be some big, big trouble. But none of those big, like, 7 to 10 inch snows with winds, just don't see it for the whole month. So that's good and bad news. We need the moisture. We certainly don't want to go into spring like we were last year with kind of a snow drought, although we did pick up enough precip last year to kind of make things work as we headed into spring. But other than that, it was pretty...
Yeah, we more than made that up with... Yeah. Once we had spring start, we had 3 weeks of rainfall. I'm not worried about us being dry and needing to take the snowpack right now. We'll likely catch up. Mother Nature's pretty good at that for us. I think, you know, at least from a farming situation right now. Plus, with the two drier summers that we've had better yields than we've had in really wet years. So that makes a difference for us as well. We also have less of a disease problem in crop at that point. I think the bigger question a lot of people have would come down to, you know, with this warm, we get warm, we get cold. The patchy fog has brought out a lot of ice. And I noticed that traveling on Tuesday. A lot of ice, a lot of patchy ice, black ice. That's made travel pretty hazardous. So hoping to keep folks from that situation. Maybe when it's so super cold, we don't get a lot of this ice problem that we've had on the highways. That would be nice if we didn't anyway.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. And I, like I said, it looks pretty quiet between now and New Year's around here, so that's good news there. Finally, we have some some good news in the forecast. Okay.
Yeah. All right, so we got that covered. Good. All right. Now, as far as some things, it's post-Christmas, maybe you're doing a little bit of shopping yet. You know, if you're thinking about what are those end-of-year purchases you might be doing for the farm. Well, here's one, and I have a little sarcasm to go with it, but it's called the auto weigher. So if you are a livestock producer, there's a lot of times you need to have accurate measurements of your weight of your cattle. So perhaps to do rations to make sure that you're giving the right feed rations for average daily gains to increase. If you have a sick animal and you need correct dosage for them, you want to be able to track their weights from birth to yearling if you're doing EPDs or other birth records on commercial cattle. What this auto weigher does is it's literally a mobile scale. It comes with a robust axle system and tire kit. It's got big knobby tires to go over rough terrain and pasture and rangeland. And it's a mobile scale because it feeds off of cellular service. So if you can literally send a text message, this thing will work in the pasture for you. It won't work everywhere, but you can give it the information to follow a cow that's got a RFID tag. So something that's got the little ear tag that they can track the computer chip in it, and it will follow that cow. It's got a little trough that has molasses or salt or something that will get that cow's attention. And when the cow steps up on the scale, she or the bulls would get weighed, and that information would wind up being sent over to the producer via phone. So it's pretty cool that this thing could work and could literally track someone down. Now, I have to laugh because that mobile scale is one that I probably wouldn't want following me if I was going to be using it like a New Year's resolution that I wanted to lose weight. So best of luck if the scale starts tracking you down. But I thought that was pretty cool. A mobile tracker that can go find you. So one more thing that's out there that people are looking forward to using out in the field or out in the pasture from time to time.
That's awesome.
But that's awesome. Just one item.
Well, Bridget, okay. We're upon break right now, and we're having a couple of technical difficulties with our guest today. So we're going to take break here a little bit early and connect with our guests. When we come back, we are going to have Brian. He's the author of Land Rich, Cash Poor, He will be on air with us. If you have any questions for Brian or for us, be sure to shoot us a call, 701-293-9000. Again, that's 701-293-9000. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Weather and Ag in Focus. Thanks for joining us here on WDAY. Very much appreciated. Hey, it's post-Christmas. If the family's left but the fridge is empty, maybe you want to swing by Great Harvest Bread Company over on South University. Cassie and the gang would be all ready with soups and sandwiches ready for you. And if you haven't had enough cookies yet, she has fresh baked ones every day, as well as scones to go with that hot cup of coffee. So give her a try. Great Harvest Bread Company over on South University. They'd be happy to see you. So I want to introduce our guest for today. And we have an author joining us. So for the new year, if your resolution was to read more books, I would hope you would reach out for this one. It's called Land Rich, Cash Poor, My Family's Hope and the Untold History of the Disappearing American Farmer by Brian Reisinger. Now, I haven't had a chance to read it yet. My copy is currently on its way to me. So, Brian, I look forward to you not only introducing yourself, but giving us a little background on your story. Welcome.
Hey, thank you both for having me on. I really appreciate it. It's great to be here. And I guess the best I can say about the book is I'm trying to answer a question that I've been carrying around my entire life. I grew up working with my dad from the time I could walk. And as long as I can remember, there were guys driving into the yard saying, you know, this farm went under, this farm sold. And so why is it that our farms are disappearing? What is it that's facing our family farms? Even though we have such proud agriculture in states like Wisconsin, where I'm from, in North Dakota, South Dakota, all across the Midwest and across the Great Plains, there's such proud industry. But also there is this disappearance. It's been such a challenge. And why are so many farms going by the wayside? So the book is an attempt to answer that question. I took a job off the farm in business journalism and later public policy. And I decided I would research all the errors of history that drove the disappearance of our family farms. Why is that happening? And then wove that with my family's story, four generations of survival from the Great Depression on up through today.
Okay, where do we even start with? Because I hate to ask too many questions and give away the whole premise of what you've written, Brian. So when I think about major hurdles that really brought to fruition where we're at today in farming, can you think of the one that maybe stands out the most, or is it more like a domino effect of what's brought us to where we are?
You know, it is a tangle of issues, I'll be honest, but if there was one central thing, I would say that it is that our country has always failed to understand the unique and really deep ways that economic crises hit our farms. You know, we've got ups and downs in our economy. We've got crises that have hit the country from the Great Depression to the Great Recession to COVID, you know, all these issues that affect our economy. And over, our country fails to understand how that affects farmers and not only the farms, but, you know, the food that they produce. And so many of us who've grown up on the ground in farm country understand aspects of that, but maybe didn't have a sense of the big forces at play. And so the reality is that our country time and again has misunderstood the way that one economic crisis or another is hitting farm country. And as a result, we end up losing more farms than we need to.
Tell us. Go ahead, Dan.
Oh, I was just going to say, I just got an email in, Brian, from one of our listeners saying, that they feel that the general public doesn't have enough knowledge on how the local farm works, going from farm to table, and asking what can be done to educate the public more to help out local farms. Is that something that could be done easily?
Yeah, well, it's a great thing that needs to be pursued. The challenge is just getting all of us to move in the right direction all at once. You know, there's all these forces that have driven the disappearance of our farms. And one solution is the fact that I think people care more about where their food comes from than ever before. That's a good thing. That's to some degree a post-COVID thing. One of the good things of such a terrible time that we had is that people said, hey, what is going on with my food supply? You know, why can't I get what I need in the grocery store? Now, why is it, you know, so much more expensive? The price is through the roof. Couple years later, still people care about where their food comes from more than they have. And I think that is an opportunity for us to do something about it. Everyone moving in the direction of making decisions about how they get their food that's tied a little bit more to what exactly is going on with our farms locally.
So Brian, will you talk about your farm? You know, you mentioned you're in Wisconsin, et cetera, and kind of what's your history and how you got to the point of using that title, Land Rich, Cash Poor?
Yeah, well, you know, our family has experienced something I think so many of your farm families in your listening area have as well, which is that each generation has to figure out how they're going to make it. And we go back to the early 1900s. My great-grandfather and great-grandmother, they escaped pre-World War I Europe to try to find a better life, and they found it by digging a living out of the dirt in the hills of southern Wisconsin. And they survived the early 1900s as we moved from subsistence farming to kind of modern agriculture. My grandparents grew up in the Depression. They survived the Depression climbing into the middle class. And my parents took over in the 1970s, 1980s. They actually faced a drought their first year of marriage. My mom still married my dad in 1976. And they got through that, and they managed to do it without taking on a whole lot of debt. And they were very lucky that that worked out that way, because then came the farm crisis, the 1980s, that wiped out tens of thousands of farms really in just one decade. And then my sister and I are fourth generation. My sister's working to take over the farm from my dad. And we grew up through globalization, the recessions of the early 2000s, mm-hmm. and so on. So what we found is that generation after generation, our families have faced economic crises. And, you know, it's the same for so many farm families. And I guess the only difference with us is that we decided it was time to tell the story.
And Brian, you hear a lot about corporate farming hurting kind of the mom and pop farms. Can you explain what corporate farming is? A lot of people might not really realize exactly what that means.
Yeah, you know, we wrestle with that issue in the book, because there are a number of farms in this country that have gotten so big, and they do end up creating pressure on the smaller farms. Here's the issue. Those farms that have gotten so big, they got that way trying to survive many of the same challenges and problems that the small farms are trying to survive. One way to survive it is to get economic scale. So they get bigger and bigger. They end up being able to take on thousands of animals, many thousands more acres, and they do it with fewer people breaking their backs to do it. And so that is one way to be able to survive that. I think that some of the critics of that point to it and say that, you know, these are farms that are really quite big, and they serve the kind of processed food industry. And, you know, they have concerns about the welfare of the animals and welfare of our environment and things like that. We wrestle with that, though, because that is one way to survive. And so many farms that weren't willing to get bigger did end up having to go by the wayside. And so many of those farms face some of the same challenges and struggles that medium and small size farms do as well.
And I think, Brian, one thing that we need to define is when people say corporate farming, understand that doesn't mean that McDonald's owns a farm. Okay. Walmart right. doesn't own a farm.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So right. we've got to remember that that's not a true definition. But that's yet what a lot of consumers or those not in ag might think it means. Corporate farming yeah. simply can mean your business structure. And it could be several entities together. There are some laws, depending on the state that you're in. You have to be related by blood. You know, you have to be father, sons. Sometimes that excludes even cousins. There are some states that just took corporate farming laws off the books that said, you know, it couldn't be women. It can only be men. Wow. So wow. there's a bigger story there, too.
There absolutely is. I'm so glad you said that, because, you know, one of the things I was shocked by, and by the way, my sister would appreciate that as someone who's taken over our farm from my dad. But one of the things that I found that was shocking to a lot of people was that actually 96% of our farms in this country are family farms. And that includes mm-hmm. the small farms and the medium-sized farms that people think of and are sad to see go. And we hope we can find a way for them to survive, of course, more so in the future. But that also includes a lot of larger farms. And as you said, there might be a corporate structure to certain aspects of these farms in terms of the way that they're organized, but they're family owned. And so these are still farm families in most cases, 96% of them, whatever their size, small, medium, or large, are still owned by families who are just trying to find a way to make it. And they are, even the bigger ones, they are trying to support multiple generations many times. And also, they're still the little guy in our agriculture economy. You know, our entire American economy is dominated by large consolidated industries. And so sometimes even the biggest farms are the little guy in the market that they're selling into.
That's exactly right. And in some ways they've found a great niche, because they can work directly with a large corporation to supply them with product, which makes them more profitable, but makes them look like they're the corporate farm. It's a very blurry line. It just in my yeah. opinion.
It's very tricky. One of the things that we talk about in the book, when I acknowledge we wrestle with that, we try to find ways that we can find solutions. Where in the history of what has happened to our farms are there ways that we maybe went wrong and things that we could have done differently? And one of the things that we talk about and that I found in talking to a wide range of experts, and it was true of our experience as a family on the ground working to survive these conditions as well, is that, you know, your big farms, they serve a purpose of supplying the bulk of our food. They also have the ability to compete on a global scale in the commodities markets. But then with more and more people caring about where the food comes from, there's also a place for the medium and small size farm to carve out a niche and to be providing either local and regional food, you know, that's fresh and local and people can buy right where they know where it comes from. The other thing that they can do is provide to specialty food markets. And in Wisconsin, we have a great example of that. We're very proud of our Wisconsin cheese. And there are farmers of all sizes that contribute toward selling milk to not only large dairy processors, but also a wide range of local cheese factories that make all kinds of varietals that are sold all across the country. So whether it's local fresh food or whether it's specialty markets, I think there's a place for our small and medium-sized farms to be able to compete, in addition to the fact that we do have some bigger farms that had to get that way to be able to continue to supply other aspects of our food supply chain.
Brian, there's a lot of bigger questions for us to ask with you, and we're going to do that when we return from bottom of the hour news. For those who are listening and want to ask questions of Brian, and again, Brian Reisinger, he is the author of Land Rich, Cash Poor. You can call us on the Red Wing Shoe Line, 701-293-9000. When we return, Brian, I want to visit with you. You talked about globalization, and now I have some other questions when it comes to farming. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Weather and Ag in Focus. Thanks for being here. And as well, a big thank you to our guest. That is Brian Reisinger. He's a farm family guy from Wisconsin, and his recent book is called Land Rich, Cash Poor. If you haven't taken the time to order it yet, I hope you do. I'm waiting for my copy as we speak. And if you have questions for Brian, you can reach us on the Red Wing Shoe Line, 701-293-9000. We're happy to take those calls. And Brian, when we were visiting earlier, you made mention of globalization and its effect on farming. And I've also read the book, The End of the World is Just the Beginning by Peter Zeihan. And he made mention that we're pushing ourselves to deglobalization. Have you talked about that in your book, or how did it affect any parts of your research that you might have been doing?
Yeah, absolutely. That issue of what to do about a globalized economy and what's good about it and what's bad about it and where are we headed now is definitely something we get into in the book. We talk about, as my sister and I were growing up in the 90s, globalization and really free trade taking on more and more to define what was going on in farming. And what I found as I did research on the economics of it, and what again matched with what our family had been experiencing, was that it was really a deep double-edged sword. You know, and people who grew up in agriculture and who work in agriculture in your listenership know all about this to a degree as well. The reality is that having more global trade opens up more markets, of course, for those folks who are growing soybeans or corn or what have you, to have more places to sell it. And that can mean that they can have a better price. It's also true that other countries for a very long time during what was kind of a freewheeling free trade time in the 1990s and early 2000s, other countries began to take advantage of us. China became notorious for cheating in international trade. We also had a lot of countries that weren't subject to the same kinds of standards that we were subject to if we wanted to sell into their countries. And so things got imbalanced, things became unfair. And so it was both true that many of our farmers were depending upon global trade to be able to sell their goods. And also many of our farmers were victim of unfair trade, where the reality is that other countries were getting better deals than America was. And so it really has created a very difficult situation here where we need to figure out what are we going to do about our global markets so that we can have them be open, but also how are we going to make sure that they're fair? How are we going to make sure that our markets here domestically aren't getting flooded with goods coming in from other countries that have lower labor costs and therefore are able to have cheaper products that are no better, you know, they're no more competitive than the American farmer, but there's an imbalance. And so trying to get that right is a really big challenge. I don't think that we have gotten it right. I think that's what history shows. And this push toward the idea of deglobalization, whether it's right or not, is a reflection of the fact that a lot of people, for a very good reason, are frustrated, whether it's with China or any other country that we're doing trade with.
Well, that asks the big question then. What's the silver bullet? How do we fix it, Brian? I'm hoping your book has that answer.
Yeah, you know, I think that we've got part of the solution. And I talked with a wide range of economists from different perspectives on this. And one of the things that we found is that there is room for what I'll call a targeted trade strategy. What I mean by that is, if we were to say, okay, we're going to take a tougher trade stance than we currently do, and people will say, well, that could shut off trade because if you take a tougher trade stance, if you have tariffs, other things, they're going to put retaliatory tariffs on our goods, right? That makes our American goods more expensive. Those exports are going to go down. We're going to get ourselves into trouble. So people are kind of torn between whether to be tougher or not. A targeted trade strategy deals with that by saying, hey, let's pursue, rather than doing these great big trade deals that go across the globe and have many, many products part of them, let's do individual trade deals on individual products. So another way to say it is that America is, rather than negotiating a few really big trade deals, America is negotiating many, many, many smaller trade deals. And what that means is we have more leverage when we do that. If we're negotiating with a specific country around a specific product, we can say, hey, this is an unfair trade barrier here. We want to knock this down. And they're negotiating with us one-on-one. They're going to want to try to make a deal with us that works around that product. And there's fewer trade-offs when you do that. A good example is neighboring Michigan. They sell asparagus. Farmers in Michigan sell asparagus. They aren't able to sell it year-round in many countries where we trade because those countries are protecting their prime asparagus season. But those countries are able to sell into America year-round. So how is that fair? So right. If we can negotiate with individual countries or on individual products, we can deal with unfair trade issues like that, but we can do it in a targeted way where there's fewer trade-offs. So we can open more markets and we can make sure that we have a tougher trade stance along the way.
And Brian, is this something that needs to be done through Congress, through the next president? What's the best way to tackle it?
Yeah, you know, that is largely the way, but I would say it's a 1-2 punch. And here's what I mean by that. This is an issue that the federal government will need to sort out. The next administration, future Congresses, they're going to have to decide what is our trade strategy that we can agree upon going to be. And I hope there's a way that they can find a way to be tougher on trade while continuing to open up more markets. I think the targeted strategy is the way to do that. But the other thing is that your governors in states can also do a lot because they go out to these countries and they sell what their states can do abroad, right? So think about it like the federal government does these negotiations to figure out what are the kind of the rules of the road. And then the question is, do you have governors, do you have leaders in these states who go out and say, hey, here's what Wisconsin can do. Here's what Iowa can do. Here's what North Dakota can do. Here's what South Dakota can do. Are you out there boldly selling what your state can offer, not only in our country, but in the world markets abroad if you have something to sell?
You know, you're literally talking about big trade missions that happen, Brian, and you're exactly right. Those are frequent and reoccurring, not just through what our governors do. We see a lot of commodity groups that will take part in those as well, as I watch, like corn growers, soybean growers. And not everybody loves the commodity groups. I know that. Not everyone is a fan of the soybean growers or whomever it might be. But I will say that they do bring out more openings for various markets that weren't there before. So there is some good to that as well, I would think. When you talk, go ahead, finish your comment there, and then I have a question for you too.
No, I was going to say, I think you're exactly right. And as we're doing those trade missions, you know, if we're focused on these great big trade deals involving many countries and many products, it gets trickier for our governors or our commodity groups or others to go out and find a deal that doesn't have a whole bunch of trade-offs rolled up into it as well, you know, when you get these great big deals. But if we can find a way to do the narrower deals and have many more of them, you have the ability for a governor, for trade groups to go out and say, hey, we can do trade in this country around this product. It could be a good thing. There aren't as many downsides. Let's go ahead and strike that deal. I think that's a world where it can actually free up our governors and, you know, our agriculture groups to be able to go find more fruitful markets that don't necessarily have the same problems tied to them.
That's a good point. And okay, when you think about what's happening with those negotiations with other countries or even how countries are handling what's going on agriculturally within their borders, who's doing it right? We're not always doing it right here in the U.S. Is anybody?
You know, that is such a good question. I actually think that it is fairly out of whack all across the globe. And I don't want to be pessimistic. The reason I say that is because America really led the charge on a lot of this stuff. And we set the tone, but we did it in a way that didn't necessarily keep an eye on all the things that we needed to keep an eye on. I think that there's something to be said sometimes for the way that Canada make sure that they're protecting their domestic supply. But there's also trade-offs to that. So I grew up in dairy country. And in dairy country, mm-hmm. you know, we're always talking about, do you want to go the Canadian model of supply management? And what that basically means is they really make it very difficult for milk to be imported. They really only buy their own domestic supply of milk. But what that does is it really is part of a broader system. To have that amount of control, you've also got to really limit things. So for a dairy farmer to want to add some cows to his herd, there's a lot of incredible approvals and a lot of expense you have to go through. So there's trade-offs to it all. I don't know that anybody really gets it right, but I think America is in a position to get it right here. And part of the reason for it, whether people like President Trump or not, part of the reason for it is, you know, Trump showed last time that he's willing to slap these tariffs on. And so the whole world is paying attention, knowing that he will do that, that he's willing to do it. So why not take this moment, whether you like tariffs or not, whether you like that approach or not, and say, hey, let's just go ahead and negotiate with countries in a targeted way that can use that leverage. And maybe we don't have to go to the lengths that we had to before, or that the last Trump administration did go to, whether you thought they needed to or not.
Oh, absolutely. So, okay, when it comes to your family farm, what sparked the reason for writing the book? Was it just watching the long history? Was it at the point where your sister was coming into operating it? What might have done that?
Yeah, well, as I mentioned, in some ways, the story is something I've been carrying around since I was a kid. And the thing that really sparked it is, you know, I didn't have the same talent for cattle and crops as my dad and sister do. And so I pursued a writing career off the farm. And part of that career was spent covering the economy in business journalism, investigative journalism. And I remember working in other parts of the country, Nashville, Tennessee, Washington, D.C. I remember talking to people about, oh, the good years and the bad years, you know, in between the different recessions. And I remember thinking, I'm sorry, when were the good years? You know, not to say that there haven't been good years for our
families. I shouldn't laugh, Brian,
you know?
But man, that's true.
Yeah. Sorry. You know, I mean, it is. It's, you know, they talk like when, you know, unemployment is up or down, the housing market's up or down, like, you know, and it's like, you know, look, in a lot of rural areas, there hasn't been new sources of economic growth for a very long time. And if there has been, boy, does it come hard, you know, because we all work in the fields, you know, we all work with our hands. It's just something that, you know, so many people in other parts of the country I saw just didn't understand. And so I wanted to answer that question. I wanted to say, why is it that the place that I'm from has been so left behind by the rest of our economy? And that ended up, you know, turning into this book. And I was just very lucky that I had so many family stories, from, you know, stories of my grandpa had a brother who was crippled in the fields in the early 1900s, to stories of survival as they climbed into the middle class, to, you know, my mom and dad talking to me about what happened in the farm crisis. There were so many family stories. So I just started there, and I started trying to reconstruct those stories and be able to tell them as if I was there. And I began to do the research on what was going on in the farm economy and the broader American economy in those eras as well. And as it turned out, our family lived through a lot of what was happening as these great big forces were bearing down on the American farmer.
Man, I feel like your farm family stories are going to be really close to mine. And I think this hits home for a lot of people right now. If you were across the table from someone at Christmas dinner who said, as a farm, we're running in the red, we didn't make any money this year, and knowing that fully 50% of farms in the U.S. will not make money in 2024, I think your book is landing at just the right time for many people to read it and take heart.
I hope so. You know, and I hope that farm families who live through it, or people who grew up in farm areas and want to know what this is all about, will get something out of it. I also hope that people who've never set foot in a barn or on a field get something out of it too, because this does affect our food supply. It affects the health and the price and the security of our food. And so I hope this is an issue that's affecting rural America that every American can care about on some level if we're going to solve it together.
So Brian, where can people follow you? Where can they order your book and so forth?
Yeah, absolutely. So people can get Land Rich Cash Poor on Amazon or anywhere else you buy your books online. It's also available in bookstores nationwide. They'll have it in stock or they can order it for you. And I'm online. I'm on X at Brian J. Reisinger. That's Brian, B-R-I-A-N, J as in James, Reisinger, R-E-I-S-I-N-G-E-R. And I'm also on my website at brian-reisinger.com.
Already following you and looking forward to watch as things progress. So thank you so much for joining us today, Brian.
Thanks so much.
Really appreciate your time. Thank you. Take care.
All right, folks, hang tight. We want to recap weather and any headlines we've got going on after this.
We will take caller number five to qualify for that wonderful trip to Vegas and the Eagles concert at the Sphere. So, again, caller number 5 we will take. Caller 1, try again. Your caller 2, try again. Caller 3, try again. Hello, what caller is this? Can I get your name?
This is John.
John, you're caller 4. Sorry, buddy. Try again. Was that mean? Was that sorry, John? Our producer told me to have some fun with this. So let's pick the next caller. Caller 5 will be our winner to qualify for our trip to Vegas. You are caller 5. Congratulations. Can I get your name?
You're Clyde.
Caller 5, can I get your name,
Clyde.
Please?
Clyde.
Clyde. All right. Can barely hear you on this end, Clyde. Have you ever been out to Vegas before?
A few years back, yes.
All right. Have you been to the Sphere?
No, I haven't.
Ah. Well, you know, I haven't been there myself, but I've talked to a lot of people that have been there. They said it's an absolutely amazing, amazing facility. So, Clyde, we're going to put you on hold, and our producer, Addison, will get all the information he needs from you, okay?
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. Congratulations. All right. Congratulations to Clyde. All right. Fantastic.
Well, Clyde's prize package, which is coming from American Security and Gate, also in part by Frontier Airlines and Kingpins, he not only gets airfare on Frontier for 2 round trip from Fargo to Vegas, a hotel stay, 2 tickets to see the Eagles, that concert is Saturday, January 25th, and there'll be $500 in spending cash. So for those of you who didn't get to qualify today here on Weather and Ag in Focus, don't forget that on Monday, December 30th, you can do it in person from 3 to 5 p.m. That will be at Kingpin's Social. Go join them there, 3485 Jack's Way South in Fargo. So don't think you're out of the running yet. There's still time to get in qualified.
Plenty.
Happy to have you joining us.
Yeah, plenty of time. Plenty of time. If you haven't been out to Kingpin's, yeah, that's a pretty cool facility. Both adults and kids.
Yeah. Absolutely. Stop by. Make sure you take it all in, but better get qualified. And we've got more qualifications coming throughout all the shows on WDAY. Keep listening for that sounder. You'll hear us this week, next week, all the way up until we have the January 8th giveaway party. So going to want to be ready for that as well. Lots to do going on with that giveaway for the Desperado Dream Vegas vacation. Now, before we get too far into this cold weather, it is a good idea to make sure that we have some fire prevention strategies in place. As we see folks that are thinking ahead about, all right, let's get some heat lamps and some space heaters out here. Maybe you're doing that in chicken coops with the heat lamps, etc. Remember to check that wiring on those. Keep all feedstuffs away or anything else flammable, because when we get these super cold temperatures, actually we see more fires in farm incidents. We want to make sure that we don't have potential sparks or something like the bedding, the sawdust, et cetera, that could get close to heat lamps where those animals are housed. Be cautious of that. Check your wiring. If you're putting in more tank heaters, if you have anything going on with an electric fence, because in that cold weather, those casings can crack. And also, if you have hay that isn't properly stored or was warm when you were put it away, it can overheat and it can ignite. We could see hay shed fires going on as we get into this weather, this colder weather too. So don't be surprised if something like that happens. And I mentioned the wiring. Interesting enough, I had a farmer mention this to me, that he had a mouse get into one of his trucks and eat away at a bunch of wiring. And when he was talking to the mechanic said, there are some wiring coatings on the electronics in vehicles, like trucks, cars, etc., that has a soybean coating, or they use some soybeans somehow in the production of that coating for those wires, and that might like the taste of it, and that they will get in there and chew on those more so than other
interesting
coatings for plastics. Yep.
Wow.
Yep, they like the taste of the soybeans.
Wow.
Maybe everybody does.
Right? Who knew? Well, let's do a quick recap of the weather before we take off for today. We do have a lot of clouds around the area, and a dense fog advisory has just been issued south of a Bemidji to Fergus line. So if you're traveling east on 94 down towards the cities, you're going to run into some dense fog over the next 24 hours as a pretty vigorous system rides out of the southern plains and gives quite a bit of rain. You get that warm, moist air moving over the frozen ground, and you're getting this dense fog to develop down to our south and east. So keep that in mind if you're traveling down towards the cities. Not only are you going to run into rain over the next 24 to 36 hours, but also some dense fog. We'll limit the fog here, but we'll continue with the mild weather, maybe a few sprinkles tomorrow, and then the sun returns, finally, as we head into the weekend. We don't turn colder until next week. So for Bridget and myself, I want to thank everybody. Don't go anywhere. Jay Thomas Show is coming up next.